Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pablo Picasso, titan of the art world, is almost as famous for his outsized life as his constantly changing body of work. From the blue and rose periods to cubism, classicism, and abstraction, Picasso portrayed the world and his life as no one had ever seen it. John Richardson's new biography, the third volume, covers a complicated time in Picasso's story as his art became deeply enmeshed with his personal saga. This hour on Point, Picasso's triumphant years, his obsessions and domination of the art world. And joining me now from New York is John Richardson. He's written books on Manet and Braque, and he's just out with the third and penultimate volume of Picasso's biography. This one's called A Life of Picasso, The Triumphant Years, 1917 to 1932. The New York Times calls it a powerhouse of a book, and the Washington Post says it's wickedly and sinfully entertaining. Welcome to the show, John Richardson.
Hi there.
Much as I want to talk about the third volume, remind us where we're picking up, because we're leaving aside two other books that you started 25 years ago.
Well, we start in 1917 when Picasso, remember that the World War I was at its height, and Picasso was only too delighted to get out of Paris, which was being bombed, and go to Rome at the invitation of Diaghilev, who was head of the Ballet Russe. And he was to do the decor of a ballet called Parade with Cocteau, who was his companion on this trip. And they arrived early in 1917, and very, very early on, Picasso went to rehearsal of another ballet and fell madly in love with one of the ballerinas, which is called Olga Koklova. And just before he'd left for Rome, he'd had an affair with a woman called Irène Lagutte, who had been his mistress for a bit, and she'd said she'd marry him. And then at the last moment, they were going to go to Rome together, at the last moment, she chucked him. And as, incidentally, her predecessor had done, another one, he'd been turned down by these two women he was very keen on. And so he was desperate to get married. He wanted to find some nice, beautiful, sexy, respectable girl who would father a family, and he fell madly for Olga Koklova.
Really such a common desire for someone who is in so many ways a very uncommon human being. I just want to frame this. You pick us up with this book in 1917, but of course he's born in 1881, so we're already past the early periods. He's already famous. He's already leaving cubism behind. The blue and the rose periods are over already. Just to set this, he's established himself.
Well, he'd also, the previous years, had been devoted to cubism. And in 1914, his great friend and fellow cubist, Braque, had gone to war, and as had another great friend, Derain. And these other Frenchmen who had been called up and spent the war in the trenches were very envious of Picasso for having it easy. He was a Spaniard, and therefore Spain was not involved in the war. And so he could work away, and it was a moment of crisis for him because he thought he seems to have taken cubism as far as he could, and he wanted to branch out in other areas, and he wanted to try going back to classicism and representationalism. And so everything sort of worked. He'd got this found this conventional Russian dancer who was very beautiful. He started doing representational portraits of her. And it couldn't have worked better in some respects.
What year did he get married? So he marries this.
He marries her in 1918.
She made him wait, right?
No, it's not that. It wasn't exactly she who made him wait. It was the situation in Russia. She couldn't get a visa to get into France, and she had to wait and wait and wait for that. They waited in Barcelona for 4 or 5 months. Then finally, they get to Paris. And they arranged to get married the following spring, 1918. But one morning, Olga wakes up. She's in a hotel in Paris because she was very virtuous and didn't want to live under the same roof as Picasso.
I think that's what I meant about the waiting.
The waiting. Well, she was very insistent on the one thing she had left. I mean, she'd lost her everything in the Russian Revolution, but she had her virginity, and that she was not going to, as a good Russian, virtuous, middle-class girl, she was not going to lose in a casual way. And she said to Picasso, no sex until we're married. Well, I think finally she did give way, but, I mean, Picasso had never had a woman say no to him before.
There's just something delicious about that.
And that's how she got him. I don't think that he would necessarily have married her if she hadn't been so firm in this way. I mean, he was trapped. So, okay, 1918, they're going to get married, and she gets out of bed doesn't get out of bed one morning because she can't put her foot on the ground. And she must have torn a tendon or done something really radically wrong to her leg and foot. We don't know exactly what it was. She was rushed off to a clinic and then let out 4 days later. And it had got worse rather than better. It had been misdiagnosed, I think. And she then had to spend the next few weeks in a cast, and the wedding was put off. And in early July 1918, when they get married, poor Olga, Russian ballerina, beautiful woman, is on a stick hobbling round in the Russian ceremony, which involves a bit of movement and so on, and therefore no photographs were ever taken of the wedding. And it was an appallingly inauspicious start for their marriage. And
it sounds like a sort of a perfect one for what came later.
Well, yes, you're right in that respect. It was, I mean, she had to give up her career. She would never dance again. And so she put all her energies into being Madame Picasso, and she wanted to be perfectly dressed, perfect jewels, perfect house with a butler in white gloves, nice little dinners and all the rest of it, and none of the bohemian squalor that Picasso had enjoyed in the old days. And she wasn't very welcoming to his drunken or gay friends. I mean, they were not allowed into the drawing room. And at first this worked for Picasso, because Picasso had a bourgeois streak. He came from a rather good family in Malaga. I mean, one of his uncles was a diplomat, went to St. Petersburg. Another one was the best doctor in Malaga. And he wasn't a peasant, as people seem to think, or a lot of people think. And he wanted to have an heir, because in his branch of the family, nobody had had an heir. So this was important, and he felt, Picasso felt these lot of family pressure, and that was why he was so intent on marrying this nice, beautiful, respectable girl. The life that they led in Paris is reflected in a way in his work, because it becomes very representational, very classical. He does wonderful portraits of her. There's a great early portrait of her, which she's apparently wearing a mantilla, but in fact it was a little tablecloth off a bedside table in the Ritz Hotel, which they used in place of a mantilla.
Oh, I love that one. And it looks, she sort of looks like a, well, sort of a sedate flamenco dancer, I guess.
Doesn't she? Yes. But there's a sort of slightly sort of lost look in her eyes, and she's not entering into the Spanish spirit of things at all. And she didn't smile very much in any of the portraits. And she turned out to be a rather neurotic, rather difficult woman. And not at all akin to Picasso's usual taste for sort of very free spirits, for girls who were ready to try anything and lead a kind of jolly life. I mean, he found himself leading a very restricted life. And this was a great change, and it's immediately reflected in his work.
Mm-hmm. And his pictures of her change drastically. They remain married, although he certainly isn't faithful, for quite a while.
They remain married until the separation in 1935. Mm-hmm. But in 1927, Picasso was a sort of perennial cruiser of the Grand Boulevard. I mean, he used to go out picking up girls and as did all his friends, and the surrealists who, André Breton wrote a book really about one of these encounters, Nadja, which was a great success at the time. And outside the Galerie Lafayette one day, he saw this beautiful 17 and a half year old girl, partly Scandinavian, blonde, it's very athletic, with a sort of athletic body, and he fell insanely in love with her. She had no idea who he was. He had to take her into a bookstore and show her books with his photograph on the cover, and they started an affair.
This is Marie-Thérèse Walter.
Marie-Thérèse Walter, yeah. Mm-hmm. And she was, thank God, I mean, she was a really nice girl. She wasn't particularly bright, but she was affectionate, loyal, and she fell madly in love with him. And years later, she gave an interview with a friend of mine, she said that, it was in some ways a terrifying relationship because he didn't like her to look her in the eye. He was a control freak. He was she had very little freedom, and he was extremely jealous. But she loved him, and he loved her, and she was the inspiration of so many marvelous paintings.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the life of Picasso, his work and his influences. And our guest today is John Richardson, Picasso biographer. His new book is A Life of Picasso, The Triumphant Years, 1917 to 1932. To view a gallery of images from the book, please visit our website, onpointradio.org. John Richardson, just before the break, you were describing this wonderful picture of the new teenage mistress, Marie-Thérèse. Was it called The Dreamer or the Sleeper? The Dream.
The Dream.
The Dream.
He did three paintings. He was amazingly, at this particular point in his life, productive. And on, I think it was January 21st, 1932, mm-hmm. He did a painting of his wife, Olga, of such cruelty, because by this time he'd turned against her and she became rather sick and she wasn't totally sane in certain respects. And he painted her as a monster. I mean,
yes, I'm looking at this one with the teeth at the top of the picture. She's sort of dismembered in planes and it's very scary.
Yes, and also the broken leg, I mean, the damaged leg. He uses her arm as if it's a leg, and it's slung over the side of a chair as if it was completely useless. And she's sagging. I mean, she was only, I think, 37 or something, but she looks, an old hag. And so he does this marvelous painting because it's all the stronger for being full of, in a way, not hatred, but in fury at having this wife who was getting sick, who was very difficult and neurotic, and having this wonderful girlfriend. And the whole of this period really is so fascinating, but you can only understand it if you see the wife on the one side, the sort of perfect wife who is being maltreated by Picasso in his work, and on the other side, this simple, unambitious, sweet girl who is the love of his life and who has been painted as very voluptuous, extremely sexually involved in his life. I mean, he sees her as his own penis. He sees her as all kinds of sort of rather monstrous things, but the works ooze sex.
Well, it seems unfair. I don't know what Olga thought of that painting. But at that same time, his life is flowering in other ways. You write a lot about his friends, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, and the summers that they all spent on the French Riviera. And it was interesting that Picasso sort of leads the way in the good life.
Well, this American couple who came to Paris just after World War One were extremely attractive. And they were a great success in Paris because they were free spirits. They gave parties which were fun. There was no formality or no sort of you didn't have to dress up all the time as most of the Parisian big time social occasions necessitated. I mean, they gave a marvelous famous party on a barge in the Seine, with Stravinsky jumping through a laurel wreath, with Cocteau telling everybody that the barge was going down, it was sinking, and all kinds of crazy things went on. And in 1923, the Murphys discovered that the Hôtel du Cap at Cap d'Antibes was not going, they could keep it open for a few months, because previously the Riviera, the French Riviera, was a winter resort. And the Murphys really, and Picasso, single-handedly turned it into a summer resort. And after 1923, every hotel on the coast opened its doors, and the whole of that region became transformed into a summer as opposed to a winter resort area. And Picasso had a very good time. 1923, he loved it. He became addicted to the that particular part of the coast. But he soon bored of the parties that the Murphys gave. I mean, they had wonderful people, Hemingway, Scott Fitzgerald, you name it. I mean, they were all there. Picasso didn't like sort of all found the cocktails boring, found the drunkenness rather distressing, and also the girls not available. So he sort of stopped seeing them after about 3 or 4 years. But it was an important juncture in his life and very important for social history.
Did he? Was he particularly productive during this period where he is so busy squiring women around and enjoying himself with these marvelous costume parties? You've got just wonderful pictures in the book of people in costume enjoying themselves at the beach. Was he painting at the same time?
Picasso was very odd in this respect. I mean, he was enormously productive, but he would go through fallow periods, and then, as Gertrude Stein said, you know, he would, all the, this ideas would build up inside him, and there'd be a tremendous splurge of work, and then when he'd emptied himself, I mean, he would lie fallow for 2 or 3 months, or go to the coast, or whatever it was, and then there would be another period of extreme hard work and marvelous paintings. And throughout the 20s, I mean, there's not one single year in which he doesn't produce masterpieces. I mean, I think, to my mind, it was really one of the most, that's why I call it the years of triumph. I mean, the most productive and the most exciting sort of 10 years of his life.
Now, you yourself lived in the south of France, and eventually that would lead to your own meeting with Picasso, although not during the period that this book covers, quite a bit later. But could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I moved to France with two friends of mine. We found a ruined chateau with colonnades around it, and it was for nothing, and we got it for $12,000 or something.
No, that's a great opening to a cocktail party. I once moved to France.
The trouble was that there was no water. But we finally, nobody in this particular area, which was near the Pont du Gard between Avignon and Nîmes, nobody had ever dug an artesian well. We dug one and found all the water in the world. And because Douglas Cooper, who was one of the owners of the place, had the greatest private collection of Cubist paintings by Picasso, Braque, Léger, Juan Gris, Picasso would come there all the time. Braque would come a lot. Léger came for his second honeymoon. And so it became a center of modern art. And it was, as it was near the two bullfighting centers of France, Nîmes and Arles, and Picasso was devoted to bullfights. Before the bullfights in the summer, we would have lunch with him in Nîmes or Arles, go to the bullfight together, and then we would give a party at this kind of semi-ruined chateau, and we'd get gypsies in from the Camargue, and usually Cocteau was around, and the bullfighters would come, and we'd have sort of people, gypsies dancing in the garden, and those were the days. I mean, and Picasso was at his best, and it was during these years that he had started a romance with his second wife, Jacqueline Roch.
I want to talk just a little bit about your connection to the family. Certain family members gave you permission to work on this book in the sense of giving you some of the biographic materials, right?
Yes. Well, what happened really, I mean, what's one of the things, the new things in the book, is that nobody had really delved into the personality and the life of Olga. And Olga's grandson, Picasso's grandson, Bernard, had inherited his mother's archive and all her property. And Bernard made all this available to me. So I had some fantastic photographs, many of them taken by Picasso, which gave one a very intimate idea of what life for Picasso was like in the 20s. And I suddenly realized that he was totally different people when he with his wife on the one side and the mistress on the other. And you can't understand the progress he made and the way his art changed in the 20s without realizing that the mistress on the one side and there was this sort of counterbalance with the wife. And for me, the images of the mistress are the most beautiful and sexy and fascinating. But in a way, the ones of the hated wife, because she became more and more difficult, more and more neurotic, are, to my mind, more Picassian, more violent, more scary in lots of ways. And a lot of the paintings of the wife had never been identified because nobody had cottoned on to the fact that as she was a ballerina, had been a ballerina, Picasso had invented a pose for her, he'd used the fifth position in ballet with the hands linked above the head. And so whenever I saw a rather mysterious painting, but the key figure in it would have her hands linked above her head, I realized these were all references to Olga.
I'm looking at one right now, Bathers Outside a Beach Cabana, and there's Marie Therese on the left. Not that I would necessarily recognize her. There's no hair on the figure, but she's graceful limbs pointed down, and then the other figure has the fifth position, the hands linked over the head. I want to talk a little bit more about his treatment of Olga, and we also have a call I'd like to take. Marielle is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Marielle.
Hello, Jackie. My comment, and I'm a little bit concerned about this issue that I see raised on the program. I have the feeling that perhaps Picasso helped to make this woman neurotic. We're talking about Olga. Mm-hmm. Instead of her being neurotic and poor Picasso suffering for it and turning her into a monster, which he feels has an adverse effect on his painting and on his life, I wonder if it isn't possible that Picasso's life and his temperament caused her to become neurotic. And I think this happens sometimes in marriages between artists different kinds of artists, perhaps. I don't think it's really fair to say always or to imply or think that Picasso was faultless. It sounds to me like Olga suffered an awful lot, and perhaps other women did in his life as well.
Okay, thank you for that comment, Marielle. John Richardson, could you respond to that? I mean, certainly the idea that Picasso was a satyr and demeaning to women has been around a long time, but you pull this marriage apart in a pretty profound way.
Well, I think, first of all, Olga turned out to have been a neurotic character long before Picasso met her.
A hypochondriac.
I don't know that she was a hypochondriac.
Well, so neurasthenic, much. I mean, she, is your word, I think.
Yeah, yes. I think that she was more a Soviet ballet critic called Smakov, now dead, had told me he had evidence. He had some unpublished memoir of some fellow ballerina, and where this other dancer said that Olga was very neurotic and somewhat difficult with. She's intelligent, but rather difficult with other people in the company. And I'm not saying that this justifies Picasso's treatment of her at all. Also, have to remember that. Picasso's always been accused of being a misogynist. But Picasso was born into the most misogynistic society in Western Europe. I mean, Andalusia was virtually Arabic the women didn't go out very much. The men spent, when they'd finished work, would all get together in the cafe, and then they'd go off to the brothel and come back, expect to have the wife had produced a good meal for them. And this was the society he was born into. His father was famous for going to brothels. And at the same time, Picasso's world when he was a child was very matriarchal in that There was his mother, there were two old aunts, and there was a maid. And they all, and he was the one, the father was out all the time teaching art or sitting in the cafes. And Picasso, as a child, was left alone with all these women. And he used to remember sort of hiding under or going under the table around which they all sat and seeing these huge thighs of these women. And this turned him on and fascinated him.
But you're also right, John Richardson, that he had a really difficult relationship with his mother. And you said it was one of mutual fascination, but also repressed violence. I mean, that's a pretty... And that must have linked later on to his relationship.
I don't think there's any repressed violence to his mother. I mean, Picasso was very non-violent, very against violence all his life. I mean, he was pacifist. Politically, he was trying to be apolitical. I mean, until the Spanish Civil War broke out, but he was very unviolent, and I think he was very unviolent to Olga. I think that he was a control freak. I'm not sort of excusing his treatment of Olga. I think it was monstrous in lots of ways, but I think it came from being born an Andalusian. And also being particularly controlling.
He was not violent, but certainly in these pictures, perhaps he released some of the anger and frustration that a lot of unhappy marriages. I mean, I was surprised that he actually did stay with her for decades.
Well, I think that, he was not a wife beater. I mean, he took it out on her in these paintings, and I think that was a sort of good outlet for his rage and anger. She was incredibly difficult. I mean, she used to curse him. She used to claim that he was not the father of their child. She's often portrayed with sticking her tongue out. She was always putting her tongue out at him, and I think that she triggered the violence in him, which Picasso subconsciously may have rather liked. And for a later mistress in Picasso's life, Dora Maar, told me that she thought that Picasso rather enjoyed the fact that Olga became so difficult and so neurotic. And it made her all the more interesting to sort of involve in his painting.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the complicated and colorful life of Pablo Picasso. And my guest this hour is Picasso biographer John Richardson. His new book, one of the four he hopes will cover the life of Pablo Picasso, is called A Life of Picasso, The Triumphant Years, 1917 to 1932. And speaking of the end of the period which you write, John Richardson, in 1932, Picasso has a retrospective in Paris and Zurich that brings his star even higher.
Well, I think that 1931 was Picasso's 50th year, and Picasso has had obsession about time passing, time as the enemy, time would stop him working, and his 50th birthday would have been a tremendously, I would think, traumatizing thing for him. And he set down to completely reinvent sculpture, modern sculpture. Starts in 1931, and then when he's done these great big marvelous heads of Marie Thérèse, which I think are some of the greatest sculptures of the 20th century, he then goes ahead and paints over in a period of about 3 months about some 40 paintings, mostly of Marie Thérèse, some of his of Olga, which I've just described, are far from kind, but the ones of Marie Thérèse are gorgeous, the Dream, for instance. Mm-hmm. And this culminated, he was doing this for the first really great retrospective he ever had, which was in Paris, and then it went on to Zurich, where it was criticized rather not very kindly by Jung. And at the same time, Jung realized certain things about Picasso, which nobody had yet said. Picasso's involvement in a kind of shamanistic way. I mean, he was a shaman. He saw art as having a magic function, and he was into all kinds of mystical ideas at the time, and Jung was the first person to spot all this.
Surprising that that had been missed, because obviously in these... Well, he had had the neoclassical period, painting the Italian mythology and gods and centaurs and this sort of thing earlier in the career. These heads that you just described look sort of totemic in the classic African way, with their lumpy faces and sort of the different planes of the face and body parts. I don't know how that could have been missed, really. I suppose that psychology hadn't advanced that far.
Well, I think people thought that, you know, he was very influenced by primitive art, which indeed he was. But, I mean, that what they didn't realize was that, I mean, he was like a witch doctor, and his sculptures were his fetishes, his totems. And he virtually never sold any of his sculptures in the same way that a witch doctor doesn't sell his totems. And this had been missed, I think, by most people, the extent to which Picasso regarded art as having a magic side.
He does, he calls it his diary. By the end of his life, he's produced about 20,000 works. I wanted to ask you, at what period, is this the time in which he compares himself to God?
The statement was made, I can't honestly remember. I don't think we recorded exactly when the statement was made about God was just another artist like me. I'm God, I'm God, I'm God, which I end the book with. But I think he did see himself as a godlike figure. I mean, with his amazing productivity and his sort of magical approach to the works, and the way the works mirrored what was going on, not only in his life, but in the life of his time. And this will all culminate in Guernica, when the Spanish Civil War breaks out. One thing I discovered in my book, which was amazing to me, was the fact that Picasso was so desperate not to commit himself politically. I mean, people have assumed that that Picasso was a communist from way back. Nonsense. He was...
Guernica.
Yes, but which is, of course, 1937. But, I mean, up to that point, when asked what he was politically, Picasso said, I'm a Spaniard, Spain's a kingdom, therefore I'm a royalist. And left. That was his sort of way out. He tried not to fall into the clutches of the Marxists. I mean, that was one of his things against the surrealists. I mean, he was in somewhat in flight from the surrealists. Breton surrealism involved Marxism, Freudianism, doing drawings with blindfold or whatever it was. I mean, all these slightly dreamy situations. And Picasso hated all that and so didn't want to get involved with the communists, nor did he want to get involved with the fascists. However, he went in 1934, he went to San Sebastian at the invitation of the Falange, of the cultural arm of the Falange, of the fascists, and he went there. I thought this absolutely amazing until I realized, of course, what he wanted was a retrospective in Spain, and he was prepared to do anything to get it. And the moment the Spanish Civil War broke out, of course, he joined the left and became the great... he painted the greatest icon of anti-fascism that anybody had done, Guernica. But it's interesting that so shortly before he was prepared to go to fascist Spain, and if they gave him a retrospective.
What do you think? You talked about ambition in part, certainly sympathy with the anti-Franco element and the Republicans. Do you think he had a political awakening much, much earlier? You write about how moved he had been by the wounding all the way back to World War I of his friend Apollinaire. I mean, was there a moment that really broke through for him about the suffering of the Spanish people, for example?
Well, I think Picasso had always been... He tried to sort of keep his, as I say, remain apolitical, but, I mean, he was a, at heart, I think, an old-fashioned liberal. I mean, who wanted, you know, freedom and poverty to be done away with. I mean, he had such rather idealistic views. But at the moment that the Spanish Civil War broke, even before when the miners struck in Spain and were machine-gunned by the fascists, there was absolutely no hesitation. I mean, he became the most the biggest voice of anti-fascism by painting Guernica. I mean, that was the icon of anti-fascism.
Let's take a phone call here. You're listening to On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, and Kathy is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy.
Thanks
welcome.
For taking my call.
Welcome to the show.
I was just calling because I heard Picasso, and I was all excited. I knew virtually nothing about his life, so the show has been really fascinating. I actually have quite a large tattoo of a Picasso on my upper left arm.
Really?
Yes.
Hope it's not the one of Olga that we've been talking about. What is it?
No. No, it's actually of one of his beautiful doves in flight. It's an abstract, of course, and it has flowers coming from under its wings, like it's, you know, it looks like it's soaring and dropping flowers on people, and it's holding what I believe is either a bunch of flowers in its feet or olive branches. And I actually, the reason I got this tattoo at several years old now was in remembrance of my mother who had died that year. And just because there's something so beautiful and flowing about it, and she loved to draw and to paint. She was not an artist. She was a stay-at-home mom when I was growing up, but there was just something about it that reminded me so much of her, of this, like, you know, the spirit flying away.
This is fascinating. I hope you send me a photograph of it, because Picasso was interested in tattooing, and I had a tattoo on my arm, and which I got in America, my first trip to New York. And then I went back to see Picasso. He said, "What's that?" He said, "Why the hell didn't you let me do it?" And I said, "Well, I'd." He said, "Yes, I was going to tattoo Braque who was in the days of Cubism." And he said, "I was going to do a great big Cubist still life on his back. And why don't I do one on your back?" And I said, "Fine." But he said, "My methods, I don't have a machine." He said, I would do it just like people do it in jail, you know, with a needle and a lot of ink. And it would be extremely painful. But at least you'd be able to sell your skin, flog it at Sotheby's or Christie's for a hell of a lot of money." Unfortunately, he never got
around
to
doing it. I don't
know
how you were able to turn him down, John Richardson.
I didn't turn it down. I said, "Please, please, please." But he said, "It's going to take a hell of a lot of time." And indeed, it would have done. I mean, a big Cubist still life, my God, it would have taken a year. And alas, it wasn't done.
Then you'd have to be in our studio with the, you know, we'd have to ask to see it, I'm afraid. I do want to ask you, have written two previous books. This wonderful book, which is as intimate as the parties that you must have attended, that you attended with him. It has such vocal clarity. You're going to do another book, and you're not a young man. I mean, why did you at some point say to yourself, "I want to be his biographer," or did this sort of grow? Would you mind sharing your age with us?
I'm going to be 84 in February,
mm-hmm.
So I haven't got much time. This last volume took 8 years to write, and
He lived to be 92, so
yeah. And I suppose I'm going to have to devote the rest of my life to coming up with the fourth one, which is when I was around, so I know where all the bodies are buried, and it'd be, you know, fascinating to do. But I don't work as fast as I used to do, and there's a hell of a lot of research to be done, because nobody has really dug into Picasso's life. I mean, there have been endless books about his so-called surrealism, which he never was, about so many different approaches to Picasso, about his politics, about his lack of politics, about his, you name it. But there's never been any kind of digging into the facts of his life. And one of the problems there was that his first good and serious biographer, an Englishman called Penrose, wrote an excellent book, but he loved Picasso, and didn't want to offend him, so it's a portrait without shadows. Mine, I think, is an accurate portrait. I've based a lot of it on Penrose's first attempts to do this. And I want to add the shadows and indeed fill in the details and fill in the holes and so on, and show Picasso as the genius he was, and a total paradox. Whatever you write about Picasso, the reverse tends often to be true. I mean, he was incredibly generous. He grew up with his friends, I mean, such as myself. I mean, he gave me a great many drawings. He was the most warm, affectionate, funny, genial character. With his family, I think that it was more difficult because he lived on other people's energies, and I think that he had a way of extracting energy from his friends. And I think the women in his life just wore out. I don't think they, you know, that they remained in love with him. I mean, after he died, his Marie Therese committed suicide. She couldn't bear the thought of life going on without Picasso, although she hadn't seen him for the previous 10 years. And then Jacqueline, his widow, I mean, she shot herself because she couldn't face life without Picasso. I used to go and stay with her, and every time she passed in front, there was a huge photograph of him in the hall, and every time she went past it, she would salute it and say, bonjour, Monseigneur, comment vas-tu, mon Pablo, whatever it was. And this was sort of scary in its intensity.
Mm. Let's take a call from John, who's calling in from Concord, Massachusetts. John, hello.
First of all, it's a pure pleasure to hear someone at the top of their game commenting on a subject of great interest to your listeners. And you're doing a wonderful job as well. I'll turn it back over to you, but thank you.
Thank you. And
thank you very much.
Well, did Picasso... comment that often is made of him is that there was no one else like him, that he was sui generis. Is that, in your experience, true?
Yes, without any question. I mean, there's nobody... As an artist, I mean, he was a great painter, he was a great sculptor, but also he revolutionized so many other things. Ceramics, I mean, he completely reinvented modern ceramics. His various technical inventions, I mean, in prints, in lithography, engraving. I mean, he broke all the rules, but made new ones. And so his influence, his powers extend to the whole field of art. And he's also, which people forget, that I think he was a marvelous poet. And all his poems have been published, but they haven't been translated. And they are sui generis. I mean, they are not like anybody else's poetry, not at all like surrealist poetry. They just are a succession of blinding images. And what they really relate to more than anything else, I find, is the Book of Revelations. I mean, they're apocalyptic in their strength. And there's one person, Lydia Gassman, who was a professor of great authority on Picasso, and she knows the poems by heart and shows how they relate to the work and explain a lot of the subjects and obsessions of Picasso as an artist.
So you're sui generis yourself, John Richardson, and we only have another moment or so with you. What do you want to achieve in the final tome?
Well, I just wanted to go on with what I've been doing in the previous books, is to try and, you know, get into Picasso, remain, you know, in depth and in 3D, and do the best I can. And in order to write about Picasso, you have to be obsessed, and I'm still obsessed. So on with the obsession.
It is truly a marvelous work, and I think that whether one knows a great deal or very little, you'll enjoy it equally. It's been a terrific pleasure to speak to you today. Thanks so very, very much, John Richardson, for being with us.
Thank you, Jackie. It was a great pleasure.
Biographer John Richardson, his new book is A Life of Picasso, The Triumphant Years, 1917 to 1932. And to continue the conversation, you can download the On Point podcast and visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yeah.